Remember, it was night. Verse 30. Judas had gone out. That room held Jesus and 11 other men. What would happen now? Jesus knew that Judas had gone to arrange to betray him. Jesus knew this was it. Now the Son of Man is glorified. The others, the other 11, still had no idea, it seems. Perhaps you can picture there, these things have happened. Who's going to betray him? That's the one I give this piece of bread to when I've dipped it. And he gave it to Judas. They were still puzzled. That connection with betrayal still didn't follow through. And they thought that Judas had gone out to do quickly, to buy what they needed or to give something to the poor. So perhaps there was a sense, as Judas has gone out, they've seen him close the door. Perhaps they saw the darkness outside. So what are we going to do now? Do we change the subject? But Jesus speaks first. Jesus knew what was ahead. He knew that this was the hour. Chapter 12 tells us it was the time. Things had come to a head. Because of that, Jesus had a few things to say. He knew that by the next day, within 24 hours, he would be dead. Things needed to be said, those that he was leaving behind. In fact, he had to drive home the point that this was the point. This is the mark, the watershed. Everything would be different, going in a different direction from here onwards. The disciples were still a long way behind and had so little idea as to what would be coming about. And why would they know, apart from what he had been teaching? How could they get a hold of these things? What was ahead of them? We have some idea of it. But it had never happened before to them. And so Jesus needed to lead the way. He knew how different things would be. And that's what follows in a long section, longest of all in the Gospels, from chapter 13 right through to the end of his prayer in chapter 17. These things that he had to say to them. He gives them what's essential as he parts. Those essentials had effectively begun with his washing of their feet in the first 8 verses. His service of them, his washing, his cleansing of them by what he was about to do. And then the things that he has to teach them, the things that they needed to know, the things that were intended to hold them together when he left them. We will consider the unfolding significance of what is to come, which he calls his glorifying. We'll consider as well that primary preparation, the first thing he has to say to them for this new way. And then also in these few verses to recognize and to examine the initial response of the disciples. Jesus was not going to be allowed to just go on speaking. They were interrupting with questions. So I want to speak briefly this morning about the glory that was expected, the love that was required, and also the love that falls or fails. And the glory that was expected, first of all. We have, I think, every indication from one of the men who was present in that room, that is John, who writes, that the men around Jesus were a long way from realizing that there was to be no more triumphant entry either into Jerusalem or anywhere else in order for Jesus to assume leadership. There's a strong suspicion, at least, that that event just before this, where he had ridden into Jerusalem and all the crowds were applauding him, that that was still very much in their minds. That when he makes reference to glory, that he would be glorified. It would be along those lines that they would still have in mind. But even with that, knowing that, I'm sure Jesus was fully aware of it. He knew the heart of man, remember, back in chapter 2. But there was no other way to speak than to speak of glory, as he fills these first two verses, 31 and 32, with this matter of glory. It was like going out into the night, when he had gone out, Judas that is. This was the final step. It was on that going out that Jesus says, now the Son of Man is glorified. It was the exit of Judas that, as it were, released Jesus to dwell on the glory that was to be his. But also to concentrate on these men whom he was to leave behind. They couldn't see it. He could. This parting, this separation, he knew that they would be troubled. The very immediately next verse, chapter 14, verse 1, let not your heart be troubled. What could he give them? So that when it all happened, there would be things for them to recall, but their hearts would not be troubled. This would be one of these things. He could see that this was the moment of glory. His work was done. The last piece was in place. It was all going to unfold from here. It was irreversible. So he could anticipate that he would be returning to the glory that he had with the Father before. But he's talking about these events as glorifying him. Now, this moment, the Son of Man is glorified. He still covered that great glory he had with the Father before, is still covered by his manhood to all around him. They still could not see that. So it's what's happening right then and there that was glorifying him and glorifying the Father in him. All this lead up and the death itself is what he has in mind. That's what would be what would bring him the glory that he desired, both for himself and for God, his Father. This is what would bring the honor that is due to him. Jesus knew that what was about to happen would gain glory. There would be people who would see his glory. Again, John summarized that at the beginning of his letter. We have seen his glory as of the only begotten of the Father. But he would do it, he would gain this glory by going to his death. Hebrews chapter 12, having spoken about the saints who tell us that faith is the way to go in chapter 11, then it tells us about Jesus. Look to Jesus. And it tells us that it was for the joy that was set before him that he endured the cross and despised the shame. I'm sure Jesus had a great joy to think that he was going to meet with the Father again, to be with the Father. But I understand that that joy is also wrapped up in the fact that it was going to accomplish the salvation of his people. That he does take great joy. He receives great glory in his saving work. He was going to die. It was shame. It was a reproach. He was cast outside the city. But that was his glory. The fact that we speak of it again today And we demonstrate it in the Lord's Supper. That's testimony of that. This is his glory amongst men. Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive blessing and honor, glory and power. I was reading a book review recently where the writer of this book was aiming to, the main theme, the central theme, was the love of God. But as the review comments, many other things in that book seem to be falling apart. It dealt with some of the questions that people find most difficult. If God is loving, how can he punish so many who don't believe in Jesus? That kind of question, under that theme of the love of God, it's a useful reminder to us, as is this passage, what Jesus says here, a useful reminder to get things in the right order. I've said, Jesus knew that he was going to be separated from his people. What is it that he says first? What does he put first for them to remember? That he is glorified. That question in that book, who comes first? That book is putting man first. God's love towards man is what he treats as most important, and therefore misunderstands it. What Jesus can see ahead of himself, he puts himself first. The main thing for Jesus, as our catechism says it should be also for us, is that God is glorified. God is love. He always has been love. Before we ever appeared on the scene, God has love towards himself, towards his holiness and righteousness. These are the things that come first. And man's problem is that he doesn't put those things first. And the man who is condemned is the one who does not believe, who does not come to God in God's love. Jesus reminds us that what matters most is God himself. That's why in Revelation we read, in that holy city, nothing that defiles will ever enter in, because it is God's city and he cannot be defiled. Jesus puts his own glory first. Only then do we have any hope. Never forget the terms of his offer. The hope that we have must be founded on the Son of Man being glorified and God glorified in him. Don't forget the terms of that offer. I give you myself. God says, I give you my Son, so that you can live changed and holy and under his everlasting love. Son of Man is glorified. That must be first. And that glory here is to be accomplished in the death that he is about to die. But there is another thing that he gives to his people as he prepares to leave them. He tells them in verse 33 that he is going to leave them. I've said it already to the Jews around me. Where I'm going, you cannot come. I'm saying it again to you now. That's what 33 says. And because of this, I give you a new commandment. Remember, if Jesus is to be glorified, it means being cut off from his disciples. Perhaps you do it when you are going away somewhere, or even when you say goodbye to someone that you meet fairly often. You may well say something to them. When I go away occasionally, like going off to presbytery for a couple of days, I might well leave instructions about something. And I know that I commonly remind my family to look after each other. Jesus is going to be absent. Yes, he says, for a little while. Where I am going, you cannot come. And he is going to return to them, but he deals with that elsewhere. In his absence, what did they need to have most of all? They needed the rest. They needed all that he has to say about the Spirit and the Father and all of these things. They needed to know, needed to learn. And John did. He has recorded it with the help of the Spirit. But first of all, he says, I give you this, a new commandment, that you love one another. This is not that wider love for your neighbor that is the second great commandment. This is specifically you 11, you the beginning of the church, and through them implicitly the rest of the church too, you love one another. It's not against the wider love for the neighbor, but it takes priority, certainly in this context. He calls it a new commandment. Is it any different? How is it new? I think it is an application of that old commandment, love your neighbor, that was given out back in Leviticus. I think it is new, in that the old commandment had been lost by so many. I think it's new in that this particular relationship between them in Christ, that's new. And that warrants particular attention. I think it's new as well in that it's a renewal, much as we read early in this gospel, of grace upon grace. We need new grace constantly. Every new day we talk about as we move on in our lives. And what has been needs to be renewed again today. And so with this, he was preparing them for his absence. Remember what's going on here, that Jesus really has been the focus of their attention. When I was a boy, we had some guinea pigs, and at one point they had a litter of baby ones, and there were seven tiny little guinea pigs. And from time to time, it looked as though the mother was trying to get away from them, and she would run, but they would run after her. She was the focus of their attention. When they got older, they were able to go their own way. But here, for 3 years, these 11 men had gone where Jesus had gone. They had. Peter records it elsewhere. He says, we've given up everything and followed you. But when he wasn't the focus of their attention, they argued. Luke chapter 22 tells us of this same upper room. And in the middle of these things, John doesn't tell it, but in the middle of all that's going on that we've just been reading in John, they're arguing about which of them will be the greatest when he comes into his glory. They're not looking at him, and they argue, trying to bring one another down. Perhaps between what Jesus had just said, verse 32, that he will be glorified immediately, between that and verse 34, maybe that's where Luke 24 and following, where that comes in. But they did right then and there start arguing, well, if he's going to glory, I want to be on his right hand. Let's get a ranking between us. And they quarreled. But he says, no, that's not the way. As I have loved you, you love one another. What would happen when he was suddenly and violently pulled out of their group? Many of us, if not all of us, know the story, having come to it previously. And we know that they scattered. But he sought to prepare them. He gave them what they needed, if they would hold on to it. A love for one another as he has loved us. Is everything necessary is wrapped up in that. Take care of each other's needs and interests. You do that and you'll have the support of the rest in your need. And so he gives them what should have equipped them for the need that was just about to fall upon them. But he says another thing that he intends by this mutual loving support. Verse 35, this love is required. It's necessary for men to be held together in Christ. But it's necessary as well for a demonstration of that love of Christ. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. That's how new this commandment was. That's how new this commandment still is. Look how distinctive it is. It sets disciples apart. Amongst disciples, there can be all sorts of differences of interests. We don't live in one another's houses and lives and workplaces every day of the week. There can be all sorts of different understandings, even of biblical passages and themes. Don't you want to let other people know just how excellent it is to follow Jesus? That's an implied question behind what he says here. You 11, does it matter that you are my disciples? I'll tell you how to tell people it matters. By loving one another in the way that I have loved you. He opens up that love a little further later on in chapter 15. We mentioned it earlier. This is how we know love. That a man lays down his life for his friends. That's what that love is. He has forsaken, set behind him and covered over the glory of heaven for a time because he loved us. We tend to be quite slow, perhaps, to register just how it is that he has loved us. That's what I say. As I have loved you, so much is wrapped up in that. Dwell on it. Let it open out before you. Yes, look at it on the feast. Consider what he has done to love you. And that's the love he calls from you to me and me to you. It's because we're slow to dwell on this. We're so often drawn aside by many other things. And it's often because of this that what we call love will fail and fall. Because that's what I think we have in the next short section, verse 36 and following. You see, I'm sure that Peter loved his master. I'm sure because of so much of what we read and hear of this man. Remember in the first part of this chapter when Jesus was down on his knees, getting his knees dirty and getting his hands wet and his hands dirty with their foot dirt. Peter said, "No, that's, I can't have that. That's degrading to you. You're my master." That was his kind of love for his master. Yes, he did love Jesus. And then when Jesus said, "No, but I must, or you will have no part with me," and Peter's desperation and his love and his great passion for his master, let's see it for that. He says, "But wash everything, I must have you." His own understanding, Peter loved his master in a way that many of us would understand. And so perhaps that's partly behind this, where he is the one who asked the question, "Lord, where are you going?" Perhaps he was a bit put out that Jesus had a plan to go without them, certainly without him. And it's complicated when Jesus, second time when he speaks of this, in verse 36 says, "But you shall follow me afterward." Was it perhaps something in Peter's mind that, well, why not now? You know, Peter, afterward was a bit too late for him. Did Peter begin to think perhaps Jesus and thought he wasn't quite up to it? Did Peter perhaps remember what Jesus had said about him being betrayed? If you go back to the other Gospels, you will see that Peter does seem to be aware that things are not going to be smooth from here. There is a threat ahead. Does Jesus think I'm not up to it? But I am. I will go with him. I will lay down my life for him. Love one another, Jesus has just said. I'm going to love my master. Mark chapter 14. And Mark is reckoned to be largely based on Peter's own account of the gospel events. But there in Mark chapter 14, verse 29, if you're jotting it down, Peter said, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." He knew that there was trouble ahead, but I'm strong enough because I love you. Having said that, I'm not sure about it demonstrating a loving spirit towards his fellow disciples, the other 10. They might stumble, but I won't be. Take me with you. I love you. I will lay down my life for your sake. That's exactly what Jesus uses to explain love over in chapter 15. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Yes, it's a tremendous claim. There was a sense in which Peter did love the Lord. Jesus knew where this love would lead. Will you lay down your life for my sake? I wonder how much of a pause there was after he asked that question back to Peter. Truly, most assuredly I say to you, before the morning is out, three times you will have denied me. You have cut between us your love. Where will it be then? He gave a gracious warning to Peter. Perhaps this warning in itself was Peter's salvation. Although he did go on and fulfill this precisely. Again, Peter tells it, we understand, through Mark, back in chapter 14. So Jesus knew that the moment had come, he was passing on to glory in and through the cross that was to come. It's because of this that he gives his word. He gives a sure guide to what is good for his people. I put it that way because it's good for those who are his already, and it is good for those who are to become his by there by our witness. That love for one another not only tells people that you are Christ's disciples, but it tells you it's worth following, being his disciple. It's such a different way. But they had to ask themselves, if we are to love one another, what does it mean? As he has loved you. The same way, by laying down his life for them, for you, for me. That was his route to glory. But see what he says about his glory? That's why this is foundational. This must be first. It's that integration with his Father. It's all about depending on his Father. Yes, if God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself. It is God at work. He does this dependent utterly upon his Father. One of the beauties of Peter's story is that when he writes his first letter, he speaks of a living hope because Christ is risen. He has a different hope than he did here. The love that will fall. It may be immensely powerful at the time, but it is one that's self-dependent. And that's not what Jesus commanded. Jesus said, the love that I require from you is the love that I have had for you, which is the love of God, the love of the Father. And that's what enables him. At the Lord's table soon we will pass the bread and the cup to each other. I think it's a tremendous symbol of love for one another within the household of God. That's why we do it. That's why I don't ask you to come and receive individually from me, but that we share in this serving of one another. We have a need for mutual support and love. We have a blessing out of giving it to one another. That's what Jesus did. As he gave himself, he laid down his life for his friends. And he receives great glory because of it and by it. And when we do this communion, we eat and we drink Christ in spirit, signifying for us, it seals and it confirms that most valuable gift that he has left us of himself and his salvation and his love. That's what he has first in his mind. That's his legacy on that night in which he was stepping forward to his death. Every time you eat and drink his body and his blood, in these symbols, you proclaim his death until he comes. His death to his glory. The death of his great love. The love that he calls from his people to bear witness to him. Let that be ours. And the love that Peter himself discovered after or through that trauma of the death and the resurrection of Christ Jesus. But so far, may the Lord bless his word to us.